From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For centuries, and back to the ancient Greeks, those who would wield power studied rhetoric, the art and science of persuasive speech. Today, we dismiss it as just words, mere rhetoric. But it's still at work, from the podium, in campaign ads, on YouTube, on Twitter. Rhetoric has more outlets now than ever, and there's an election coming. This hour on Point, the ancient and new rules of rhetoric, from Aristotle to Obama, Reagan to Romney. You can join the conversation. Are you beyond being swayed by rhetoric? Are you sure? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK, and you can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's get some right in our ears, right from the top here, a speech for the ages, William Shakespeare's friends, Romans, countrymen from Julius Caesar. This 1953 film version features Marlon Brando as Mark Antony condemning Brutus in Caesar's murder, and you can hear a whole bag full of rhetorical tricks in this short passage.
I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. I am no orator as Brutus is. But as you know me all, a plain, blunt man that loved my friend. And that they know full well that gave me public leave to speak of him. For I have neither wit, nor words, nor worth, action, nor utterance, nor the power of speech to stir men's blood. I only speak right on. I tell you that which you yourselves do know.
Yeah, Mark Antony, you know me all, a plain, blunt man, neither wit nor words to stir men's blood has he. Well, maybe. Joining me now from London is Sam Leith, writer, journalist, former literary editor of Britain's Daily Telegraph. His new book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam Leith, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
It's great to have you here. And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst, wordsmith, and student of many a political speech, our own Jack Beattie. Jack, welcome.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Sam.
All right, Jack, let me come first to you, if I may. Sam, take no offense, but let us two Americans think for just a moment here about rhetoric and what it's come to mean, Jack. We'll bring it to Sam. He's paid a lot of attention to the USA and our politics here. But, Jack, rhetoric. Say the word rhetoric today, and you get, you know, sort of a woof, no thank you in the USA.
You know, you're right. I mean, politicians in Madison Avenue have really cheapened the coin. To many of us, rhetoric connotes a speech on a mission to manipulate. In our media age, you know, we ask, are we more vulnerable to word wizards or less? Does the phrase mere rhetoric disarm us against the power of public speech? Is rhetoric inversely related to sincerity, a vehicle for truth or sophistry, real emotion or sentimentality, community or division? In his arraignment of Catiline, Cicero asked 50 rhetorical questions. Did they convince or stupefy? Does windy speech like this make you pine for a world without rhetoric in which, to quote Hamlet's last words, the rest is silence?
Oh, Jack, you astound us with your rhetoric. Okay, Sam, what about it? I mean, you say right in your book, and you're celebrating a great tradition of rhetoric, you're reminding us that scholars, gentlemen, you name it, studied rhetoric assiduously for centuries.
Well, precisely.
But you say right here, rhetoric is hustling, i.e. a hustle.
Well, this is the thing. I mean, the reason I think this Mark Antony speech is such a good one to kick off with is because it demonstrates from the off that the idea that rhetoric is something not to be trusted has long ago, you know, it's absolutely embedded in the culture. It actually goes back to Plato. But the thing you notice about
because
this
speech by Mark
Antony,
he's witty or smooth. He's saying, I'm just a blunt guy.
It's a lie. Mm-hmm. I mean, that speech is a pack of lies. I come not, friends, to steal away your hearts. No, he's there precisely to steal away their hearts. And when he says, I am no orator as Brutus is, but a plain, blunt man, as if to say that Brutus is this kind of conniving, rhetorical, manipulative creature. This is, you know, he's a much better orator than Brutus is, as is plain in the play. This is one of the most enduringly famous pieces of oratory, you know, in history, this speech. So it makes clear that the first thing you have to realize when someone says, that's just rhetoric, is rhetoric's what the other guy's doing. If something sounds rhetorical to you, it's rhetoric normally that isn't working.
But what does it mean when a whole country says or likes to think of itself, and I think this may be true of the USA today, I don't know about the UK, but to think of itself that, oh, we're beyond rhetoric now. We recognize rhetoric and we are beyond it.
Well, I think what's happened is that the country has come to Nobody likes to feel that they're being persuaded of something against their will, that they're being led somewhere. But, you know, at the centre of your political process, as of ours, is rhetoric itself. You know, what is a representative parliament but a place where people go to have arguments about what ought to happen? And what is democracy but the idea that somebody's ability to stand on their hind legs and speak to the people and persuade them of a course of action should be what generates a government? You know, so... You know, you're absolutely steeped in rhetoric. What happens maybe is you think you aren't, you know. And the guy who's the effective orator is the one who doesn't sound rhetorical.
Of course, at one time we think of it as a man, typically, in a robe, standing on a high place, speaking to a bunch of people, or at a podium. What about when communication words are fractured through all kinds of media, when it's blog posts and TV ads and even tweets on Twitter? Is all that still rhetoric? Are we in an era of magnified rhetoric or lost rhetoric?
Well, I think what's happened is that rhetoric in its, you know, its original sense just means persuasive speech. And you'd apply that, I think, to, you know, blog posts. You'd even apply it to tweets. What happens is it changes. It changes its form according to the medium and according to the audience. And it always has. And so, you know, in the internet age, rhetoric won't be people standing on a podium in a sheet because people don't wear sheets anymore for the most part. You know, you'll just look weird. You know, you stand up on a big podium in a big sheet and you start speaking, you know, all veeing and howling people. And, you know, it's like Animal House. You know, nobody elected Bluto to be president of the United States of America. Yeah. So I mean, really what's happened is we're not used, you know, formal speeches, which, you know, in the Greek and Roman forums, you know, before they had, you know, entertaining things like Xbox and the TV and the internet to amuse themselves, people would go along and they'd expect to listen to 3 hours of speech. Mm-hmm. And that would be a kind of formal set piece thing. They'd take pleasure in it. They'd they'd expect to
take us on a journey of rhetoric.
Mm-hmm. But now, you know, nobody's going to listen to you. You know, you've got sound bites. You've got the quote at the top of the hour. The news is rolling 24 hours a day. And so the means by which politicians and advertisers and everybody else seeks to persuade us is just adapted to that. You know, it's adapted to an audience that doesn't want to be thee'd and thou'd at. It's adapted to an audience that has a short attention span. But what's happening is still rhetoric, and the mechanisms that underpin it are exactly the same as they were when Aristotle formulated the rules back in, you know, 400 BC on.
We'll get to that adapted rhetoric. Let's get another example, though, that's not from so long ago, not from ancient Rome, not from Caesar's day, but just as far back as World War II. It's June 1940 here. Belgium has fallen. France is about to capitulate. Things look very bad for Britain. British Prime Minister Winston Churchill's job is to keep spirits up. So he tells his countrymen Britain had always been vulnerable, but had always shown grit and honor and prevailed. It came to be known as the Fight on the Beaches speech.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender.
We shall fight and fight on the beaches, on the landing grounds, in the fields, in the streets. Jack Beattie, are we really so beyond that? There's Winston Churchill, but think back just, a decade plus a bit here, and you had George W. Bush standing in the Hall of Congress after the attacks of 9/11 with some speeches that were pretty potent in putting a mindset together in this country.
Indeed, and that's the, you know, the good side of it. Churchill actually took a defeat, Dunkirk, the imminent blitz, and made it a victory. And he did it through this rhetoric. And reporting from the time shows people repairing to it, and especially his line, you know, "And if this empire should last for 1,000 years, men will still say, this was our finest hour." I mean, that's wizardry. And I think President Bush had some of that, too, in his speech around the time, you know, "And we will come back, we will come back." But the solidarity that's created by those words can also be, can go in any direction. Once it's there, It can be manipulated in a positive or negative direction in a way that stays within the Constitution, in a way that strays beyond it, as I think the argument can be made Mr. Bush did.
Sam Leith, in London, you say rhetoric is right at the heart of Western civilization. Whatever we think of it, it is the bedrock, more than swords, more than cannon, rhetoric.
Well, swords and cannon help, you know, but in democracies you have to talk people around, and it's, you know, the origins of rhetoric in ancient Greece kind of go hand in hand with the rhetoric's the second greatest gift Athens gave us, and democracy being the greatest, but they go hand in hand. And of course, you know, you don't need to talk people around if you've got a big gun. But we by and large try not to have a situation where we're held, you know, the citizenry are cowed by martial law. You know,
And big guns only have their influence for so long, right? And sooner or later, ideas tend to get around them one way or another. Ideas
always
carried by words.
Exactly. And it's interesting that, we're seeing the Arab Spring that's been going on. So much of social media have opened up. They're given a lot of credit has been given to Twitter and to all these social media. Because the internet, in its way, you know, dictatorships try and censor the internet. They're frightened of words. You know, the Chinese censor the internet. So words always tend to, you know, they're slower, they're erosive, but they get there.
Sam Leith in London, please stand by. The new book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Listeners, you can join us. When you hear the word rhetoric, do you just think blowing smoke? And what about the art and science of public communication that goes back to the ancient Greeks? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Jack, please stand by. And Sam, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking this hour about the power of rhetoric. Yes, rhetoric in human affairs. From ancient days to right now, State of the Union addresses, political ads, tweets on Twitter. My guest is Sam Leith. He joins us today from London. London is a writer, journalist, and columnist. His new book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Jack Beatty is with us as well, and you can join us. What do you think when you hear the word rhetoric? And are we still swayed by oration, exhortation, fine oratorical structure? Do we listen for logic, for elegance, or for down-home truth? And is down-home truth well-delivered just rhetoric, too? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Let's hear another couple of famous examples, and we'll dive right into your calls and Sam's analysis. 40th anniversary of D-Day, 1984. President Ronald Reagan stood on a cliff on the Normandy coast of France, Pointe du Hoc, and delivered a moving tribute to the lives lost there on D-Day. In the audience before him, men who had lived through that day, past and present, united there.
225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. Behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Pointe du Hoc. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war.
We'll look at that and what he's saying there, but let's get one more. Talk about how rhetoric can make a difference. July 27th, 2004, the Democratic National Convention was here in Boston. Then Senator Barack Obama came to praise Democratic candidate John Kerry. That keynote speech catapulted Obama to the very top of the American political pantheon.
E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Now, even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us. The spin masters, the negative ad peddlers, who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Senatorial candidate Barack Obama in 2004, and he went on. We worship an awesome God.
We worship an awesome God in the blue states. And we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states. And yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states.
Red states and blue states, but these are the United States of America. Sam Leith, talk about the power of rhetoric there in the mouth of Ronald Reagan, in the mouth of then-candidate Barack Obama.
Well, those are two absolutely cracking speeches you've got there. And I think that to start with the Obama speech, that line, a pluribus unum, that is, you know, out of many one, actually describes exactly what any orator is seeking to do in more or less any speech. What you're trying to do is make out of many, i.e. out of yourself and out of the individual members of your audience, you're trying to make one. You're trying to unite an audience behind your point of view. And, you know, kind of bring, you know, the journey of any speech is from, you know, you and me to we. Mm-hmm. And an effective speech does that. It galvanizes an audience and it brings them together. And when you look at, to go to the Reagan point, I mean, there he's bringing almost past and present together. You know, he's looking at these guys, having just delivered a very sort of detailed speech using what in classical terms is called energia, the painting of a picture. He painted this vivid picture of these guys fighting up the beach.
Bayonets on the bayonets in the cliff.
Mm-hmm. All that stuff. And then he's got these old boys in front of him, these veterans sort of, you know, in their 80s or something, shivering on the cliff edge. And he's like, these are the boys of Pointe du Hoc.
Yeah.
And you're suddenly, they are, because they were boys. Mm. And then that speech makes another, it makes a little journey in those four terms. They, you know, these are the boys, these are the men, you know, these are the champions.
Time collapses.
These are the heroes. Mm-hmm. Time collapses, but it also takes the specific and suddenly moves out in this really kind of moving way into this something general. So he goes from, these are the boys of Pointe du Hoc right here, the men who took all these cliffs. So it goes from boys, men, champions, heroes, and it goes from Pointe du Hoc to cliffs to continent to war. So suddenly
we're climbing
you get
right
that sense.
With him there.
Mm-hmm. You're climbing right with him, and he's bringing this one moment in time and fixing it to be part of something bigger and more significant. And that's the a pluribus unum moment. You know, it's making something greater, it's fixing the moment into something big.
Mm. Sam Leith writes, we use language to cajole and seduce, to impress and inspire, to endear and justify. He writes, language happens because human beings are desire machines, and what knits desire and language is rhetoric. Let's go to our listeners. Susan in Albany, Kentucky. Susan, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I wanted to know the difference between rhetoric and demagoguery. And just as an example, say Homeland Security, where both the Democrats and Republicans seem totally unified on this, on the increasing the noose or tightening the noose around the Constitution and around our necks in terms of our rights. And is that rhetoric or is it demagoguery? I see demagoguery as very dangerous, and rhetoric maybe not so much.
It's a great question. Rhetoric and demagoguery, Sam, where's the line? Or are they just,
well,
demagoguery just one strand of your rhetoric?
Well, I think whether something's demagoguery or whether it's rhetoric depends on you know, whether you're in agreement with it. I mean, we were talking earlier about the way that rhetoric itself has become a kind of boo word, has become a negative term. I mean, I use rhetoric neutrally just to mean any form of persuasive speech. Demagoguery is really saying is the sort of thing that people who do see rhetoric as frightening and intimidating. Demagoguery is evil rhetoric, if you like. I mean, you know, the trouble is, ever since we've had rhetoric, you know, there have been efforts made to say that, you know, only virtuous men can be good orators, but the history of the 20th century shows us something quite different, alas. You know, an accomplished orator can, unfortunately, you know, work to great evil ends, but the only things we have to fight against them in the end are good orators working to the good. You know, I mean, for every Hitler, a Churchill. So, I mean, Hitler was certainly a demagogue, but he was using rhetoric, and so was Churchill to fight against him.
And you're writing here about heroes and villains of the persuasive arts. You say Cicero, Erasmus, Adolf Hitler, John F. Kennedy, all in the same sentence there, and George W. Bush and Winston Churchill, all in the same bouquet.
Well, they all spoke very persuasively.
Yeah. Jack, I mean, right there you see I would say, quite justified broad ambivalence about rhetoric, because we know in our guts that it's powerful. We are the species that is uniquely attuned and vulnerable to the power of words, and we know it can push us to good or ill.
Oh, certainly. And, you know, and we, and in addition to that, we live in a stream of advertising, which is all about, you know, swaying us one way or another. It's as if we're doomed to rhetoric. We just can't get away from it. And I think that that cynicism is actually has a civic face to it. I think it's something that is worth cultivating. And I think one of the most remarkable displays of sort of political mobilization in recent years was Ross Perot in 1992 with anti-rhetoric. He appeared on television with a marker and paper and wrote facts on it. You know, the debt is this, it'll grow by that, and here's this. And people watched and learned, and they said, my God, there was no rhetoric there. He was just giving us facts. And I think that's a – politicians could use that as a salutary example to maybe just speak facts occasionally and eschew the manifest forms of rhetoric.
Let's listen to just a little bit of that. We've got it, and then I'll get you, Sam. But here's Ross Perot, 1992 presidential campaign, Texas billionaire. He's on the stage, the independent, with a young Democrat, Bill Clinton, and the elder George Bush, the Republican on either side of him. And here he is talking about unfair trade agreements and the giant sucking sound of jobs going overseas, as he so famously put it.
Now, if you just want to get down to brass tacks, first thing you ought to do is get all these folks who've got these one-way trade agreements that we've negotiated over the years and say, fellas, we'll take the same deal we gave you. And they'll gridlock right at that point because, for example, we've got international competitors who simply could not unload their cars off the ships if they had to comply. You see, if it was a two-way street, just couldn't do it.
Ross Perot sounding very down home there in 1992. So Sam Leith in London, is that rhetoric? Is that anti-rhetoric? What do you hear?
Oh, that's rhetoric. That's rhetoric right enough. I mean, one of the things that we haven't touched on yet, but it absolutely underpins this whole subject, is what Aristotle called ethos, which is to do with how you project yourself, how you come across, mm-hmm. shaping, telling a story about yourself. And Ross Perot, sure enough, he's telling a story about himself, and the story is, I'm not like those Washington guys.
Just
I'm
want to get down to brass tacks.
Technician. Just want to get down to brass tacks. And actually, what you know he's talking about is international trade tariffs and you know a huge, quite complicated area of policy. But he's presenting it as if to say, here's something that you know anybody can see. Common sense tells us that my line is the right one. Because you never get anywhere. I mean, there may be some areas of policy that actually are really complicated and it's very hard to explain. But, you know, most of economics, for instance. But, of course, you never get anywhere as a politician saying to voters, right, guys, just leave this to me because I'm the expert. You wouldn't understand it. Don't worry your pretty little heads about it. Precisely because people don't like being patronized. They don't like feeling that, you know, some elite is speaking down to them. And so Ross Perot is coming in and saying, you know, I'm not an elitist, I'm not a beltway guy. You know, you can just do this. Margaret Thatcher did the same in the UK. She presented the balancing of the budget as, you know, basically a kind of, she's like, I'm a housewife, I know how to look after my grocery bills, so I can balance the UK economy. You know, I mean, it's
nice, again, simple equation, very, and it's powerful.
It's a powerful ethos appeal. It's saying, you know, look at me, I'm doing something simple that everyone can understand. I'm one of you. Saying I'm one of you is the most powerful appeal a politician can make.
Sam, remind us of those many years, centuries, when rhetoric was something that was widely studied by educated people. What did they study? It wasn't just public speaking. It wasn't just presentation. If you studied rhetoric, what did that mean? What was some of the structure in there that they were learning?
Well they would learn, you know, grounded in the classics. Because this was, and the founding fathers, the framers of the American Constitution, all went to grammar school and learnt rhetoric as part of the trivium, grammar, logic, and rhetoric. That was what you learnt in a grammar school. And they would study Cicero, they'd study Seneca, they'd study the ancient texts, and they'd learn to spot, you know, the figures of speech, the little curlicues, like the word, I mean, you hear politicians doing them now, what anaphora is when you repeat something at the beginning of a sentence, you know, I'm going to be a president who does this, I'm going to be a president who does that, you know, or tricolons, grouping things into groups of three, you know, I have neither wit nor words nor worth. So they'd be very conscious of how you put together a speech. And actually one of the things they talked about, the five canons of rhetoric are invention, arrangement, style, memory, and delivery. And that's basically a one-stop shop for turning a set of thoughts into a speech. Invention, you figure out what your arguments are going to be. Arrangement, you put them in order. Mm-hmm. Style, you add all those lovely little curlicues and doohickeys and tricolons and anaphoras and epizeuxes and whatever you have. Memory, of course, this was the days before teleprompters and auto cues. You would have to commit this to memory. You'd have to kind of get the speech in your head. And then, of course, delivery, because having the most wonderful, persuasive, well-grounded speech in the world is absolutely no use to you if you then just, you know, fall off the podium when you're trying to deliver it.
And they studied it, and they made a deep study of it. Now we still do it, but it's kind of off the cuff. Maybe it's just in the blood. Anime is calling for... Oh, I'm sorry, Sam, please.
Oh, sorry, I was just going to say this is the argument I think I'm trying to make, is mm-hmm. that it's something we do. It's something we do naturally, but we can do it better if we understand how it works. But more to the point, you know, if we're worried about rhetoricians and orators getting one over on us, mm-hmm. if you understand how it works, you're much better equipped to resist it.
Sort of know what's coming at you.
If you see them coming, mm-hmm. yeah.
Enemy in Charlotte, Vermont. Enemy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. This is a perfect segue. I have a question for Mr. Beatty. Namely, I would like him to talk about Frank Luntz, the Republican pollster and crafter of pregnant expressions, and about George Lakoff, the person, the linguist, who mm-hmm. talks about the larger frames behind it. So it's not a question per se, but I would mm-hmm. like him to talk about these two people who really influence how we think and how we see things.
It's a great thing to raise, Enemy, and thank you for doing it. Jack, I mean, in these two, Frank Luntz and George Lakoff, they are focused on, I think sometimes we think that these buzz words and buzz phrases have come to dominate rhetoric, that in a way in our modern, postmodern world, we've broken the code and realized, you know what, all that ornate structure, if you just get the right core fundamental framing, the little seeds within it are more important than any flourishes you'll build around it. What about those two? Dive in, Jack.
I think that's exactly right. And look where Frank Luntz found it, in focus groups. He went out and mined the popular mind and found that when you called the inheritance tax the death tax, suddenly yeah. support for it went way up. And he, you know, he created an issue that had pretty much been settled since 1912, that big estates should be inherited. The death tax? No. How can we tax death? And it appealed to people's sense of justice. Mm-hmm. So there, he goes out, he finds the word, he labels it, and it works. And I think that is exactly what people and when presidents give speeches, they're not just giving speeches. Those words, leave out the sentences. The words have been laundered and focus grouped, and they're picked to manipulate us just so, and not anymore. And you know, Lakoff, I think, has made a very good point that the Democrats are really worse at this. They try. But they're worse at this. Maybe they're better now with Obama. But he wrote before Obama. But that they weren't quite as good at it as the Republicans, because the Democrats kept talking. They thought that, well, mm-hmm. people will, you know, let's have more evidence. Let's just keep no. laying it out.
No.
And that doesn't count against the death tax. That's what works.
Sam, what about it? Is it possible that we have stumbled onto something, for better or for worse, you know, that phrase makers, meme makers, have undermined or overwhelmed rhetoricians?
I think meme makers are they're still doing rhetoric, I'd say. I mean, what, you know, Cicero had sound bites. You know, what the business of actually controlling the language is something that's vital, absolutely vital to how you make a speech work. And, you know, of course, even you can see in the States in your forthcoming elections, you know, all the candidates are kind of trying to take possession of the words that are in the founding documents, like liberty, you know. Mm-hmm. It's you're trying to frame the terms of the debate in a way that will be satisfactory to you.
Sam Leith, please stand by in London. The new book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. And Jack Beatty, please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. What do you think? Whose speeches have moved you in your lifetime? Is it all just sound bites now, all buzzwords? Does rhetoric still matter? Are President Obama's speaking skills still helping him? Does Mitt Romney's awkwardness hurt him or help him? 800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the power of rhetoric. Yes, rhetoric. In human affairs, from ancient days to right now, State of the Union addresses, political ads, victory speeches, Twitter. Sam Leith is with us from London. His new book, and it's a good one, is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. He's got all the engineering of rhetoric in there that for centuries and centuries people studied, made a real study of. It is still at work in our time today, very much at work, he says. We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. What do you think about the power of rhetoric today? Here's a couple of examples. 1952, then Senator Richard Nixon, under fire, accused of misusing political funds. He fired back with his famous checkers speech. Nixon turned the charges into subtle self-praise, saying the gift he got was a cocker spaniel named Checkers, and defiantly said he would keep the dog. He laid out his family's finances to show he'd never enriched himself from his campaign funds.
Well, that's about it. That's what we have, and that's what we owe. It isn't very much, but Pat and I have the satisfaction that every dime that we've got is honestly ours. I should say this, that Pat doesn't have a mink coat, but she does have a respectable Republican cloth coat, and I always tell her that she'd look good in anything.
Sam Leith, what was going on there in 1952, rhetorically?
Well, rhetorically, he was pouring on what we rhetoric scholars like to call the nacho cheese. that you know, Republican cloth coat. And
no
that
mink,
is,
no
you
mink
know,
coat for my Pat.
Exactly, no mink coat for my Pat. And that's actually the you know a wonderful climax in a speech that's all about doing what I said just earlier, is one of the most powerful and, you know, consistent things that politicians always try and do is to say to their electorates, I am one of you. You know, you never want to be the guy who's sailing around with a cigar with a wife in a mink coat, you know.
So you say, but if I may, let's put it up against a guy with a cigar. And no doubt, I don't know about a wife, but maybe plenty of women with mink coats. Here's Rush Limbaugh, the opposite of humble Dick Nixon there. 2009 Conservative Political Action Coalition Conference in Washington. Radio host Rush Limbaugh got a huge response from his audience, outlining the tenets of the modern conservative movement. Rip Snorton.
We do not look out across the country and see the average American, the person that makes this country work. We do not see that person with contempt. We don't think that person doesn't have what it takes. We believe that person can be the best he or she wants to be if certain things are just removed from their path, like onerous taxes, regulations, and too much government.
Yeah, we don't believe all these ugly things. Therefore, Sam, they must. They do.
Yes, exactly. I think what he's doing there, very attractively and effectively, is stating exactly what he says he is stating, actually, which is the kind of optimistic conservative position that, you know, rather than saying, well, we believe that you know, the weak should go to the wall and only the strong survive, which is a much less attractive way of framing that kind of idea, you can say, well, no, we believe that people have the power to lift themselves out of poverty, to, you know, be the best they can be as long as the state gets out of their way. You know, the liberal version of that story would say, you know, without help from the state, you know, some people are not going to make it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, I don't want to get into the politics of that because it's a serious ideological argument. But it's, you know, you can see how, once again, you know, you frame the position as favorably as you can to yourself. You know, you say, we're not being negative against the weak. We're being positive mm-hmm. about the strong. You know, you... and that was, that was Rush on non-shock jock form, actually. That was him making a really serious speech, and I thought it was the better for it.
Well, you can hear it most days of the week, some version of it from Rush. Jack, lots of response online here. ADK says, people in the U.S. beyond rhetoric? That's hilarious. People in this country are convinced by rhetoric every day, 24 hours of news, political speeches, blogs, etc., everywhere, and people don't think on their own. Leora says, still teach it. Students listen to Hitler, Churchill, Graham, Chaplin, great dictator, Obama. They learn the power and skill. And Grayman writes, He asks you, Sam, if you'd hazard an opinion on the dread substitution of charisma for rhetoric in contemporary politics. What about that? Are they interchangeable or substitutable, Sam?
I think what's happened is that, the charisma is a lot about, if you like, the ethos appeal, because, you know, candidates more and more are not arguing at length about policy, particularly not on the stump. I mean, they'll have these kind of policy points, but so much more of it is how they project themselves. You know, have I got my arm around my wife and one hand in the air? Am I, you know, bowling the opening pitch? Am I having a kind of backyard cookout that makes me look like every other guy? Mm. And so charisma goes a hell of a long way, particularly in a television age, you know.
Jack, let's bring it back to Barack Obama and Mitt Romney. That's the campaign we've got in front of us, and Sam has been watching that. And he writes in Words Like Loaded Pistols, he says, the story of Barack Obama's campaign for the presidency is a great instance of both the power of rhetoric and the power of hostility to rhetoric. And you can see that right on through his administration's time, Jack.
Oh, certainly. You know, his command of rhetoric really is a double-edged sword. Among his base, it raises expectations, phrases like the hours when the waters began to recede. No president could meet such expectations. There's a great gulf between the poetry of his campaigning and the prose of his governance. And to GOP voters, his flair, it really furthers their view of him as a dangerous sorcerer of persuasion. And in Washington, his speeches not only don't persuade Republicans because they polarize public opinion, they make it next to impossible for them to vote for one of his bills. He really exemplifies the crisis of what a political scientist calls the rhetorical presidency, meaning the penchant of 20th century presidents to address the people directly, to mobilize them, to pressure Congress to pass their bills. This tends to alienate Congress, which won't act. So the president cranks the rhetoric up, indulges in crisis rhetoric. This ups the ante even more, so that even if he wins, he loses credibility and the scheme of deliberative government is weakened. You know, in Federalist 49, James Madison warned that popular appeals from president to people, that was the road to demagogy, and it could grow presidential power beyond the limits set for it in the Constitution. And you could argue that has been a 20th century story.
Sam, you're our rhetoric master today. What about it then? A rhetorical presidency. I mean, it would seem by you're taking us back to Cicero and Aristotle and looking at the power of it. Now, here's a president who by, you know, Republicans in this country complain about the teleprompter, but almost everybody concedes he's very good at the public speech. So what about, do you tip over into somehow being too dependent on that?
Well, I think that there's two points. Certainly, the point Jack made about the rhetorical presidency is could not be better expressed. I mean, I think that's absolutely right. There is the internal mechanism of, you know, he's alienating Congress by speaking over their heads. I think the other problem he had is exactly this, that he's now an incumbent. You know, he was able to make a very effective campaign on promises when there was no data on the ground. He was fighting an incumbent, you know. Now he's weirdly in the situation that, Romney is in the situation that Obama was, whereas Romney can say, a new America begins here today, time to kick the guy out. And Obama, you know, is much more vulnerable to the charge of being a kind of windy orator now that there's actually evidence on the ground of, you know, how far he has and has not got to, you know, how much he's achieved. So I think he's on a stickier wicket.
But, Jack, it wasn't just pretty talk. I mean, when he said, you know, we're not red states or blue states, but the United States of America, people were responding to that. There was an idea there that people wanted to respond to, and much more than just that idea. Maybe he's, for all his fluency, maybe he's not good enough at getting the ideas across. Or are you saying he's more LBJ, sort of elbow grease and less talk?
Well, whether elbow grease would work with the Republicans, I don't know. But there was a paper recently about the minimum wage fight. And basically it argued that he was talking privately with Republicans about let's raise the minimum – I mean, not minimum wage, the cut in the payroll tax.
Okay.
Forgive me.
Mm-hmm.
And they were debating that back and forth privately. And then he gave a speech on it. And Republicans said, we can't deal with this guy now. The inside game, we might have done it. Once he gives the speech, because of the nature of the parties today, it's a zero-sum game, they had to polarize. So his speech there actually hurt the policy. But I do think that at his best, you mentioned one instance. The other instance would be at the service for the dead in Tucson and the shooting mm-hmm. of Gabrielle Giffords and the murder of mm-hmm. six people. There, I think he really touched the superlative. He transcended politics, and every American, I think, listening could be moved and could feel that in some way he had drained this horrible experience and found the meaning in it. That really, I think, is his greatness. He can do that. It's just hard to find those occasions.
It's funny how greatness can also be vulnerability. Even Hillary Clinton, Sam points out, sought to slight him as a man who just gives speeches. And Mitt Romney using some of that as well, not known as a rip snorting orator exactly, but here he was. This was April 24th. He's had a string of victories in the primaries, and he gave his victory speech in Manchester, New Hampshire. Here he is laying out Obama's, as he describes them, failures in office. But you can hear the dig at the president's rhetorical skills right off the bat, suggesting that the president is just silver tongued, fancy pants. Here's Mitt Romney.
4 years ago, Barack Obama dazzled us in front of Greek columns with sweeping promises of hope and change. But after we came down to earth, after all the celebration and the parades, what do we have to show for 3.5 years of President Obama? Is it easier to make ends meet?
No.
Is it easier to sell your home or buy a new one?
No.
Have you saved what you needed for retirement?
No.
Sam Leaf, I have to say, I think I could hear some version of that given, from beneath some pillar in Rome. But there he is, you know, Obama dazzled us in front of Greek columns, no less. Talk about an insult to rhetoric, and you're Aristotle.
Yeah, well, he said, I mean, that's Greek columns was a lovely gift to him because he was able not only to connote, you know, rhetoric, but also a great theme of Romney's campaign, Europe, which I know you guys don't look too kindly on. It doesn't poll too well. And Greece is, you know, about to disappear down the economic dustbin of history. So, associating Obama not only with classical rhetoric, but with the failure of the Greek economy and with all things shifty and European, you know, that was doing some work. But it should be said, even in that short bit, you know, let's not pretend Romney's not being rhetorical.
Absolutely.
Hope and change is what the classicist calls synthetan. This whole series of questions to which the audience are railing out the answer. That's hypophora. You know, dazzled actually is very clever because dazzled, you know, sounds like a piece of praise, doesn't it? But of course, dazzled has connotations of not being able to see.
Right.
So it's actually, that's a very artful piece of rhetoric. I mean, this is the thing. When people say that guy's just a creature of rhetoric, they don't start campaigning in mime. They don't go out and go on the stump in interpretive dance. They keep making speeches.
I think we will not see Mitt Romney in interpretive dance, but hypophora exercise there. Greg in Boston. Thanks for calling, Greg. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. As a freshman at Syracuse, I accidentally enrolled in a rhetorical theory class, and I ended up, well, here I am 12 years later, and I'm finishing my dissertation in rhetorical theory. So I just wanted to expand to the concept that we've kind of expanded our understanding of what rhetoric is beyond just speech. And we're now including in rhetorical theory, like the study of iconic photos, memorials, music, and how all of these different forms of human interaction function rhetorically. So we've really broadened our horizons, and there's so many parallels between all these different mediums that rhetorical theorists are looking at.
Well, stick with us, Greg. That's really interesting. In the digital age, the multimedia age, where there are just a lot more options. Only wizards could produce all that in the old days. But now, Sam Leith, we can be marched at with words, rhetoric, images, music, crazy combinations all at once. Do they all somehow fit in the same satchel?
I think they do. I mean, branding, you know, which is, of course, you know, it's enormous political weather in branding. And, you know, iconic images absolutely are about rhetoric. They're about reaching into, because, you know, rhetoric is about finding common ground with the audience, about finding a sort of store of shared assumptions and shared ideas. And brands are absolutely that. You know, the brand, the credibility of the brand, the ethos of the brand, people even talk about brand ethos, brand identity. You know, that sells us a lot of running shoes.
So, Greg, what's your theory, dissertation writing, Greg? Can we be swept away these days without a word being spoken, just to have all the other, armaments of media deployed, images, music, all the rest?
Oh, definitely. I think, it, you know, all you have to do is walk along the Vietnam Memorial and just see the, you know, the nature of the, you're feeling, you know, a pathos. We mentioned ethos earlier, but the emotion that kind of sweeps over you with seeing some of these images, it definitely makes an argument without words needing to be, you know, helping to facilitate those arguments.
Good luck with your research. I'm really glad to hear from you, Greg. That's a good point. Tammy in South Royalton, Vermont. Tammy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. It's Cammie, actually.
Sorry. Great.
Yeah, no problem. I was a competitive speech and debate coach for a high school after doing it in high school and college myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught for 2 years before my program was ended. And my comment is just that these programs and this education for speech and debate in the United States is disappearing, and fewer students get exposed to that. And I think that you can, you know, you can see a connection between that lack of education in these skills and that American shift towards suspicion and disdain of rhetoric. It's hard to appreciate something, whether you yourself are good or bad at it, but it's hard to appreciate something if you don't understand what's going on. And I just think that's horrible that we're losing this tradition of appreciating these skills and talents.
Cammie, it's a great point, and our time is so short, but I'm so grateful for it. Sam Leith, what about it? I mean, Americans have grown overtly, deeply suspicious of rhetoric, but Cammie makes the point implicit there is that, and you say earlier, democracy is built on the idea of persuading one another, and if we're losing talent at it, perhaps we're losing the nuance of doing it effectively, perhaps as part of gridlock and disrespect.
Well, it's very sad to hear that the you know, public speaking is falling out of U.S. curricula. I mean, I don't know where these students are going. Maybe they're going to Madison Avenue. I mean, as I say, there's more rhetoric around than there ever has been, though it's in less traditional forms, probably, and forms that are less visible to us. You know, we've got our defensive guns trained on what we think of as rhetoric, while sneaking around the back are, you know, hordes of Madison Avenue madmen.
Jack, what do you think? Could we use more skill at it, or does that just make us more slippery? Do we need it to get across the, you know, sort of thread the needles of all the challenges we're faced?
I thought Cammie really put it well. It would demystify it. And also, it would impart a skill. I've seen studies that say that nothing predicts achievement in college so well as skill at debate. That if you were to train high school students in anything, do it in debate.
Sam Leith, you educated us as to what we're up to every time we open our mouths, and we're grateful for it. The new book is Words Like Loaded Pistols, Rhetoric from Aristotle to Obama. Sam in London, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, always great to share rhetoric with you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.